everyone, welcome to another episode of A to Easy. So today we're going to be focusing on biliary colic. Now there's loads to talk about here because we're not only going to talk about biliary colic itself, but we're also going to remind ourselves how bile is formed. Trust me, it's helpful. And we're going to look at the three main complications of biliary colic, which are acute cholecystitis, cholangitis, and acute pancreatitis. So hopefully covering loads of ground in just one episode. But before we get stuck in, welcome to Yvonne.
Hello, everyone.
Yvonne, thank you for joining me on this whirlwind of biliary colic. To start off, as I say, we're going to actually just look at the physiology of bile. Do you remember much of MCD?
No, it's been a long time.
Yeah, no, same here. But there are some things that are helpful to recall when we're thinking about, yeah, the function, the composition, and the role of bile.
Okay, such as...
Let's start at the beginning. Bear with everybody. This is going to be 1 to 2 minutes of quite dry, but I promise you very, very useful material. Firstly, starting with the bile salts. So these are the cholesterol-based molecules that are produced by the liver. The hepatocytes that secrete the bile salts along with bilirubin, which gives bile like its brown colour, as well as cholesterol, phospholipids, ions, and proteins. And that's all within a solution that's about 95% water. So if a consultant, you know, first day affirms is like, what is bile? Tell me what bile is. Just list a couple of these things. So we said bile salts, bilirubin, cholesterol, phospholipids, ions, proteins, and water. That's bile. Remember for later that cholesterol is excreted via the bile. That's important. So excreted by the hepatocytes, it's then pushed down the canalicular system, which is like the space between the hepatocytes, and then down the common hepatic duct, so out of the liver at this point, into the cystic duct, and then into the gallbladder. If you need a reminder of how that all joins together, check out the link we've got in the episode notes. Now, the role of the gallbladder is simply to store the bile. The role of the bile is to help us digest fats via emulsification. So what happens is you eat a fatty meal and the gallbladder will contract to release the bile. It flows down the cystic duct again, now down the common bile duct, and joins with the duodenum and the pancreatic duct at the sphincter of Oddi. Now the bile is in the small intestines, it can emulsify and help absorb all the fat you've just eaten. Then 90% of the original bile salts are reabsorbed and circulated back to the liver to start it all over again. And this big cycle happens 6 to 8 times a day. It's ongoing.
That's quite impressive, actually, that it's going 6 to 8 times a day. Thank you very much. So, okay, that's what happens normally. So, and that's the physiology. What's the pathophysiology when things go wrong?
Yeah, well, that's why it's useful to know what happens when it goes right, because there's only really two things that can go wrong. Either the bile composition is off, or the bile can't flow down that lovely route we've just described. And if either of these things can happen, that's when stones form.
And you can have different types of stone, right?
Yeah, that's right. And they're just named after whatever their main component is. So cholesterol stones are the most common, but you can also get pigment stones, which have a higher proportion of bilirubin than normal, as well as mixed stones, which just have a sort of equi mixture of everything. There are also different words used to describe where the stones form. So these are Greek words, Yvonne, so please help me out if I'm pronouncing them terribly wrong. So the presence of stones actually in the gallbladder itself is referred to as cholelithiasis. Oh no, cholelithiasis, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Cholelithiasis. Meanwhile, if the stones aren't in the gallbladder anymore, but actually in the common bile duct, they're called choledocholithiasis. So it's just got doco in the middle, essentially.
Basically, I'm going to chip in there. Cholelithiasis, whatever you want to pronounce it. Choli, which is like where the choli part comes, means gallbladder in action in Greek. And lithos, where it's like lithiasis, is stone, which practically means stone in the gallbladder. Cholidocholithiasis, well, choli against choli. Doco is like dohio, which means storage place. So refers to the common bile duct, the duct which kind of like connects the gallbladder with the intestines. And then lithiasis stone. So it kind of means that it's not in the gallbladder, but it's actually in the storage place to the intestines. And that's the difference, basically.
No, that's good. I feel like, yeah, knowing why these words are formed in this way is super helpful to actually remembering them and hopefully remembering how to pronounce them as well. So we've got cholelithiasis, that stones in the gallbladder, and then we've got cholidocholithiasis, which is stones in the common bile duct. It is important to know the difference because it does influence both investigation and management, and actually the risk for specific complications, which we'll cover later.
Okay, so we have stones in the gallbladder, which is cholelithiasis, and then stones in the common bile duct, which are cholecystolithiasis. And they're important for the management and the complications. And when do we worry about gallstones?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question, because actually 10 to 15% of people have gallstones at any one time. Like, it is pathophysiology, but it's not necessarily a disease because it doesn't cause symptoms all the time. Only 1 to 2% of people with either cholelithiasis or cholecystolithiasis become symptomatic each year. And that presentation of the gallstones being symptomatic is what we call biliary colic.
So although like 10 to 15% of us probably have gallstones, only 1 to 2% of us get to actually have symptoms of gallstones, which are known as biliary colic.
Yeah, although you made it sound like it was a prize, like only 1 to 2% get to have symptoms. I'm not sure it's... but yes, yeah, that is right, yeah.
No, special 1 to 2%.
Yeah, very special 1 to 2%. So yeah, and that's all the nitty gritty really. So now we can move on to sort of classic risk factors and presentation. Think about the presentation. The main thing to remember is it's pain, and it's pain in the right upper quadrant because that's where the gallbladder is. Essentially, the gallbladder slash the biliary system is contracting against these stones, and thus causes pain. It can also be exacerbated by the fact that these stones are probably blocking flow of other bile out of the gallbladder and down the common bile duct, which means it's inhibiting even proper contraction and causing more pain. And this usually comes on after a fatty meal, because that is when you are stimulated to push the bile into your duodenum. Thinking about the characteristics of the pain, if you're using like an Isocrates history, it's going to be a strong pain, like more than 5 out of 10. This isn't a little twinge. And it's going to last a minimum of 30 minutes at a time. This is important to remember because actually biliary colic is a bit of a misnomer. Colic suggests it's a spasmy pain that comes off and on again. And it does, but it's on for quite a long time. And that's different to renal colic, which is much more of a transient strong pain.
Okay, so the main symptom for biliary colic is pain, usually about 30 minutes. And I think I remember a trick to remember the risk factors. And I think it's something about 4 Fs.
Yeah, this is really classic. It's the idea that the stereotypical patient who presents with biliary colic is fat, 40, female, and fertile. Although this is like a major simplification and also somewhat offensive, it's, you know, kind of useful to know because it does come up that way in exam questions, and it does all link back to our physiology. So if we think about the first two being female and fertile, that's because of the estrogen that that patient has at that time. Estrogen has two effects that increase the risk of gallstones. Firstly, it increases contractility of the sphincter of Oddi, which increases the likelihood of biliary sludge, and therefore that predisposes to the formation of the stones. And estrogen also increases cholesterol deposition in bile, which again increases the risk of stone formation. However, remember that HRT also increases a woman's level of estrogen, and that's given after the menopause. So the patient may not be fertile, but will still have the same level of risk. Thinking about the others, 40 as referring to the patient's age, this bit isn't actually 100% accurate. What actually happens is that the incidence of biliary colic becomes 4 to 10 times more likely after the age of 40. But it actually peaks at like 70 to 79. So these patients that you see in hospital versus an exam are actually going to be much older than 40 in most cases. The 40 in the classic 4S is still useful though, because as most women go through the menopause in their 50s, the age 40 does represent that like intersection between increasing risk with age and increasing risk from estrogen. Just remember to keep gallstones on your list of differentials for patients in their 70s as well.
Okay, so we discussed about the female and fertile and about the 40. What about the other F, and more politically correct, the overweight part?
Yeah, so there's a few different theories for this. No conclusion exactly. Being overweight is also linked to increased cholesterol secretion from the liver, which predisposes to bile stone formation. And there's some evidence that people who are obese have decreased motility of their gallbladder as a whole. So there isn't a single conclusion in the literature. It's probably due to a number of factors. So that's the 4 Fs. But remember, we did say that there were different types of stones. The four S, as we've now summarized, actually link to the cholesterol type, which is the most common type of stone.
Okay, so we have the four Fs, fat, female, 14, fertile. And those are risk factors for cholesterol stones. So what are the risk factors for the other stones?
Yeah, good question. So risk factors for pigment stones are anything that results in excess bilirubin. So think of conditions that cause a high turnover of blood cells, your classic being a hemolytic anemia. Also, we can see pigment stones in patients with severe cirrhosis because they have an increased secretion of unconjugated bilirubin from the hepatocytes because of the failure. So our patient, they're in pain. It's usually sudden onset pain in the right upper quadrant, comes on after a fatty meal. Their obs are normal and we've offered them analgesia. What do you think we should do next in terms of investigations?
Some blood, maybe scan?
Yeah. Good answer. Covered all the bases. You would do like a routine set of normal blood, so you'd, as always, do FBC, CRP. But what you must always include for anything you suspect is biliary colic is your LFTs, your liver function tests. What you'll see is a big rise in ALP rather than AST or ALT. Your ALP is rise compared to the others because it's the cholangiocytes that are being damaged, not the hepatocytes. Remember, this is a biliary system problem, not a liver problem. You may also want to chuck in a serum amylase to rule out acute pancreatitis, which can also present with sudden onset pain in like the epigastric region, and on top of that can be caused by gallstones themselves.
Okay, so LFTs and a serum amylase. What about the scan?
Abdominal ultrasound. It's the single best diagnostic test for cholelithiasis, at least. It's slightly less good for visualizing the gallstones in cholelithiasis, but it will also show you any bile duct dilation that occurs from that too. Remember, gallstones, the cholesterol ones at least, are radiolucent, so it's always ultrasound over a CT or an X-ray for this condition.
Okay, so we have the LFTs and serum amylase, and we also have the ultrasound, which is better because of detecting the radiolucent cholesterol stones.
Yeah, perfect.
And how would we manage gallstones? Does it make a difference whether it's one or the other?
Yeah, it does, actually. So for symptomatic cholelithiasis, I say symptomatic because remember, we all have gallstones, well, 10-15%, but they're not a problem until they become symptomatic. And cholelithiasis is when the gallstones are in the gallbladder. Your first line of management is a laparoscopic cholecystectomy. Meanwhile, for cholelithiasis, where the stones could be in the biliary system instead, you actually need better visualization of where they exactly are. Because remember, we said that abdominal ultrasound will show you that the ducts are dilated, but it may not show you exactly where the stones are. For that, you might use something called MRCP, which stands for magnetic resonance cholangiopancreatography. But everyone just says MRCP. As it sounds, this is like an MRI scan that is able to visualize specifically where the stones are in the biliary system. Once you visualize them, you can then use ERCP to remove them. So a little bit more information about that. ERCP stands for endoscopic retrograde cholangiopancreatography. So this is where you use an endoscopy tube. It's inserted via the esophagus to the stomach, down into the duodenum, to the sphincter of Oddi, where the pancreatic duct and the common bile duct meet. And then you can use the endoscopy tube to not only affirm where you think those stones are from the MRCP, but you can also use it as a kind of catheter to wiggle the stones out. Okay, so for cholelithiasis, first line is laparoscopic cholecystectomy, so you go straight to theatre. If you don't know where the stones are, you suspect it's cholelithiasis, you need to first visualize where they are using MRCP, and then you can use ERCP to actually remove them. And I personally found learning exactly how ERCP worked just made the anatomy of the whole system stick in my head way better. So if you need to rewind and listen to my description again, or like get up a diagram at this point, I think it's a really good idea. It really helps you learn the anatomy.
Okay, so if the stones are in the gallbladder, the best management is laparoscopic removal. Whereas if you suspect that in the common bile duct, then you use MRCP to visualize them and then ERCP to actually remove them.
Yeah, that's it. It's perfect.
Okay.
And with patients who have cholelithiasis, and they have ERCP to remove them, it doesn't stop them from having like an elective cholecystectomy at a later date, especially if they have recurrent problems with gallstones. Because if you have a cholecystectomy, you remove the cause.
Okay. So we've discussed about the management, but before you kind of mentioned about complications, so which complications were you referring to?
Yeah, so we've like covered so much ground. We've talked about the formation of bile, we've talked about how that can go wrong, we've talked about how the risk factors link back to that, we've talked about the presentation of biliary colic, investigations and management. We are doing awesome. But as I said at the beginning, there are three very important complications to be aware of from gallstones. They occur, one of them will occur in about 3% of patients' gallstones, which makes them actually pretty high incidence. And as well as that, they're very, very hot topics in exams, so worth knowing about. The three are, and they're a bit wordy, but we'll go through them each: acute cholecystitis, ascending cholangitis, and acute pancreatitis. Okay? So number one, acute cholecystitis. This is specifically associated with cholelithiasis, so where the stones are in the gallbladder itself. And it can be described in several ways, but my favourite way is a worsening of the biliary colic, in that the contraction against the stones has caused like sufficient inflammation and bile stasis to allow actual infection in the gallbladder. So acute cholecystitis refers to infection in the gallbladder from gallstones. According to the technical definition, the only way really to differentiate it from simple biliary colic is that a patient with acute cholecystitis will have had pain in the right upper quadrant for over 5 hours continuously, not a minimum of 30 minutes, over 5 hours continuously, and will have likely started to show systemic symptoms of infection, such as fever. There are also two helpful signs on examination which can help us differentiate again from acute cholecystitis versus simple biliary colic.
Wow, 5 hours of pain is a long time. Okay, very useful to know some differentiators, but what about the signs?
Yeah, so useful to know, come up in SBAs a lot as well. The first one is called Murphy's sign. So this is where you place one finger under the right-hand side ribs. You're thinking costal margin, mid-clavicular line. And you ask the patient to breathe in. As the patient breathes in, their lungs are going to expand, the diaphragm, liver, and gallbladder all move down. The inflamed and tender gallbladder will sort of catch on your finger, and this will make the patient, A, increase in pain, but they kind of draw in their breath as it happens because it's a sharp pain. This is then Murphy's sign positive. If by putting your finger under there, asking them to breathe in, and it causes a catch of pain, it's Murphy's sign positive, and you're thinking it's more likely to be acute cholecystitis than simple biliary colic. Murphy's sign positive, acute cholecystitis.
Okay, so Murphy's sign positive, acute cholecystitis. Fair enough. The second sign?
So the second sign is called Boaz sign, and this is where the pain from their right upper quadrant weirdly radiates through the back to the right scapula. And now this is neuro, but basically if the gallbladder is irritating the liver capsule, the diaphragm might be disturbed when your cervical nerves C3, 4 and 5 innervating both the diaphragm and the shoulder. So the brain just mixes up the signals. It thinks that your diaphragmatic irritation is also shoulder irritation, therefore perceives pain coming from the back of the shoulder instead of the diaphragm. Again, this shows that the gallbladder is severely inflamed, likely infected, and therefore we say that if the patient is Boaz sign positive, you're thinking more acute cholecystitis than simple biliary colic.
Okay, so acute cholecystitis, you're going to have Murphy's sign, possibly, and Boaz sign. Boaz sign is referred pain from the diaphragm to the shoulder. And the management for acute cholecystitis, different to biliary colic?
So the ultimate treatment is still cholecystectomy, which is the same as acute cholecystitis, but this is now an urgent procedure. The patient may classify as septic, so the sepsis 6 protocol comes in, fluids, antibiotics, etc. Essentially, the patient is a lot more sick, so requires a lot more supportive care, and there'll be a lower threshold for ITU admission.
Okay, so you need cholecystectomy as well. You might need to use the sepsis 6 protocol if they are septic, and then it needs urgent cholecystectomy. So
yeah, that's right.
Okay, so we discussed about the first complication. What are the two other possible complications?
So the next one we're going to talk about is ascending cholangitis, more fun Greek words. This is specifically associated with cholelithiasis, so gallstones in the common bile duct. So remember, cholelithiasis, we're thinking acute cholecystitis as our main complication. Cholelithiasis, we're thinking ascending cholangitis as our main complication. It's very similar in pathophysiology to acute cholecystitis, in that essentially the prolonged bile stasis in the CBD leads to bacterial colonization and infection. It's called ascending cholangitis because the bacteria then tend to ascend up the biliary tract to both the gallbladder and the liver as well. We see that this presents with something called Charcot's triad, which is right upper quadrant pain, as we know, fever, signifying as infection, but now also jaundice.
Okay, so Charcot's triad indicates ascending cholangitis, and it involves right upper quadrant pain, fever, and jaundice. And jaundice is a differentiating factor from the acute cholecystitis, for example.
Yeah, and that makes sense, doesn't it? Because here, the stones and the surrounding inflammation are in the CBD, so that blocks any excretion of bile at all, which then eventually will cause a backlog of bilirubin. Stones in the gallbladder, meanwhile, aren't necessarily preventing that bile excretion.
Okay, it makes sense. And the treatment for this?
Similar to acute cholecystitis, these patients, they're really sick, they'll need urgent IV antibiotics and supportive care, think sepsis 6 again. And once they're stabilised, they go to theatre for a biliary decompression procedure.
Okay, so similar to cholecystitis, may need IV antibiotics, sepsis 6 protocol, and they're taken to theatre. And the last complication?
Yep. Acute pancreatitis. So this happens when the gallstones in the common bile duct block the pancreatic duct as well at the sphincter of Oddi. You get a backlog of pancreatic enzymes and it's extremely damaging to the pancreatic tissue. But I'm not going to say any more about it now because actually quite a lot of different things can cause acute pancreatitis, not just gallstones. And we'll probably cover acute pancreatitis separately in another episode. For now, just remember that gallstones is a cause of it.
Okay, so three main complications of gallstones are acute cholecystitis, ascending cholangitis, and acute pancreatitis.
Yeah, perfect. And that's it.
Hey guys, it's Harry with your 30-second summary. So, biliary colic refers to symptomatic gallstones in either the gallbladder, cholelithiasis, or the common bile duct, cholecystitis. The patients will present with right upper quadrant pain greater than 5 out of 10 in severity, which lasts for more than 30 minutes at a time. The way to remember the risk factors for biliary colic are the four Fs: fat, female, fertile, and 40. You would see a raised CRP and ALP on bloods. The main investigations and management are an abdominal ultrasound followed by cholecystectomy for cholelithiasis, and MRCP followed by ERCP for cholecystitis. The three main complications of biliary colic seen in 3% of patients are acute cholecystitis, ascending cholangitis, and acute pancreatitis. Patients with acute cholecystitis can be Murphy and SOAS sign positive, which are less common in simple biliary colic. Thanks for listening.